What is up, everybody? Patio Slave Podcast, episode number 36, 9 months into the Patio Slave experience, which is pretty cool. It is November 12th, 2020, and I'm here, as always, with Anthony and Nate. How you guys doing?
What's going on, man? I'm doing fantastic. How you doing, Nate?
I'm doing great, too. Thirsty Thursday, sober October's done, so I'm hanging, drinking with you guys tonight. It's great.
Hell yeah, man. So peep us on the socials at Patio Slave on Twitter and Instagram, patioslavepodcast@gmail.com, where we answer all emails we get from fans and listeners and friends alike. So go ahead and check those there. We had a guest tonight. Nate, you want to intro our guest?
Absolutely. We had Ben Collins, who's the guitarist and vocalist of the band Chronic Future. So you may remember me bringing this band up on, what was the name of that segment? Why wasn't this band bigger? Yeah. And we kind of prefaced that in the episode a little bit. But yeah, man, he was great. Came on, talked some backstory, a little bit about the album that I mentioned on that episode, It Lines in My Face, which I love. And it was just cool for him to come on. He really gave us a great snapshot of the industry, because his career spans early 90s till I think 2006, and some one-off reunions and stuff. So really cool for him to come on. So we're going to get into it with Ben Collins. Hey, what's up? Here with Ben from Chronic Future tonight. And I want to tell you, Ben, I have a little quick story about your band. First time I heard them, I was kind of a late bloomer. It was 2004, so Lines in My Face had dropped. And we're all from Portland, Maine. So one of my good buddies, Rob, who's actually been on this podcast before as a interview, as a radio personality, called me. One of those like classic moments where he called me from the station. He's like, hey man, the rep Rodney from Interscope came in, good friend of all of ours, and dropped off this CD, and I think you're really gonna dig it. He was spinning it to play the single to get it on the air, whatever. I'm like, cool man, I'll be right by in about an hour. And we played the whole record in the studio, and I was like, this record's fucking awesome. He's like, yeah man, Rodney's really pushing it, hoping that something happens with them and so forth. So ever since, I say late bloomer because I know you had a few releases before, but I was really into the album. And we did a little segment a few episodes ago. We were like, man, this band is awesome. I feel like I'm the only one or one of the few people that actually like really knows about them. And it was like this thing where it's like, man, I want everyone to know about this band. So so I really appreciate you coming on and talk a little backstory on the band, if you will.
No, I was, it's funny because I think after you did that podcast, a friend of mine named Fred Feldman, who runs a label called Triple Crown Records.
Ooh, yeah.
Hit me up on my Instagram, was like, have you... and connected me to the post you guys had made. So I appreciated that. Sorry. So what was the first question you just asked me there?
Oh, so not out of no disrespect at all. It was really just like, man, I really like this band and I feel like no one knows about them. This new record just drops and me and my buddy are telling everyone about it and trying to see gigs. And I remember being super bummed because there was no gigs that you guys were playing up in the Northeast. I think the closest one was
getting up to Portland, Maine.
Yeah. The closest gig was with Papa Roach and Trust Company. I think it was in like Providence, Rhode Island or something. I'm like, damn, I can't get down there tonight.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember playing Providence a few times. No, it's funny you say that. I mean, we had a long, pretty long career. I think as far as like bands go, we started when we were just kids, like 14 years old. But I think it was just one of those things where when we got started, we were really ambitious, even though we were super young, and like just found our way into playing club shows. And I think there was a bit of novelty definitely to the fact that we were so young back in those days. And like, we were like playing like clubs and whatever. So it kind of started for us, I think, in the sense that we were able to just play local shows and rise up through the ranks and get like, we had a couple lucky breaks and we were able to play with bands like 311 or there was a band in Phoenix back in the late 90s called the Funk Junkies. And they were like huge as far as like Phoenix was concerned. And they definitely took us under their wings and I would say like showed us, gave us a bit of credibility really in that sense. It's funny to think of it that way now, but it definitely like gave us some like legitimacy when it came to, like our local scene. And I think gave us like the confidence at a really young age to sort of have that belief that we could do it and dedicate ourselves full time to it at the ages of like 15, 16, 17, 18 years old. Like we really stuck with it.
Yeah. And that's super early. And we, in coming up with questions to ask you tonight, I think that was one of the questions we had, like, what are some of the positives to starting that young? You know, it's the energy thing must be one of them. But like, how many influences are you pulling from at that point? You're super young.
I mean, that's all we really were at that point. I think in the earliest days of our band, like that, we really wore influences on our sleeves. You could say it took us a while to figure out that combination of styles and sounds that I think what you hear in the album Lions in My Face. I mean, it took us 7-8 years to get to that point. We had been a band for a really long time by the time that album dropped. You know, we like signed a record deal when we were 15 years old. I think we had been through 2 record deals even before we got onto Interscope Records. So I mean, we had really grinded it out in a lot of ways. We were like kind of veterans by that point in terms of the amount of hours we had spent playing together and the fact that we'd been touring since we were just kids at that point. I think we were in a really good position to take that on. And to be honest with you, I think Lines in My Face just suffered from like kind of bad timing. It like didn't come out early enough to be like to ride the wave that bands like Papa Roach had or a lot of those other bands that like broke on the radio initially. And by the time 2004 rolled around, like there was the scene and like things like more like My Chemical Romance were popping off, and you know, it like rap-ish rock bands were sort of over at that point in a lot of ways, even though like what I think we brought to the table was a bit different than all of that. We just sort of missed in that sense, like looking back on it. And then I think really like for us, like it just sort of, I guess by that point we had been in the band for like 10 years. And I think we were all approaching our mid-20s and all of us had like vastly different, like wide ranging interests that we never had been able to like pursue because we had started so young that I think in that moment, just in like kind of a healthy way, everybody sort of started exploring other avenues really. And just time went by and it wasn't ever like a situation where we didn't want to like be in the band anymore. It just sort of like, we sort of grew out of the band all the while, like still maintaining like very, very close friendships. Like I was just with Brandon, our bass player, like this last weekend. 3 of us live in New York now. Like we've always kind of always continued our lives together in that sense. It was just like the band paused at that point and never really restarted.
It's funny you say that, because when we were kind of, you know, in like a pre-production meeting, we were talking about how your music interests from when you're 15 to when, like you say, 25 are different. I didn't even think about just like outside of music, like what your interests that are kind of put on hold really for the most part, because all your creative energy is going towards the band. So that's pretty cool perspective, which I didn't think of. And at that point, you're probably like, all right, I'd like to maybe do something else, right?
It was that, you know, definitely that. And I think just, we were doing other stuff. So, you know, a thing like we really, like for myself personally, as the band was approaching like the post Lines in My Face days, I'd always had just really a huge interest in starting a record label, which I started like kind of as like the touring wound down of Lines in My Face. I started working more and more on that side of things. And I really found that to be really rewarding, to be honest with you. And I just like, the grind of touring would like, for myself, speaking for myself, it really worn me out. I just wasn't in a place where I wanted to just keep like grinding on the road. And I think for bands, especially in those days, I think it's really why you see like the numbers of bands dwindling in a lot of sense in terms of like touring and how many when kids are coming up now, like their willingness to join bands and be in a unit with 3, 4, 5 people is difficult because it's really hard to make it work financially, you know? So as you start approaching 30 or getting into your late 20s, you wonder like how sustainable that can really be. And then you're really just faced with the prospects of like, really like, what do you do when you're like 35 and you've been in like a band your whole life? And where do you go from there? Cause I really think that you start, you know, you look around and you look at like the longevity of any band or any successful artist. I mean, the idea of being like the Rolling Stones is a complete lottery ticket at that point. So not to say like not to crush people's dreams, but I think that those days it was especially just difficult to like think of the idea of just like just touring like that and just having that cycle be your life. And we just started just things that like started blossoming in our lives that like we didn't expect. This record, the record label that I speak of is one of them. And started working on projects in those days, and it just found myself moving from Phoenix to New York, and the projects that I was working on sort of behind the scenes had some success, and I found that I needed to really devote myself to those things to really see them through and make sure that they were successful. You can only do one or the other, really.
Ben, I'm so interested. I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, like at 15 to now today, I'm 36. I've had so much ebb and flow in my career. And obviously playing music that young, you kind of worked your way up, indie label, Interscope, you know, major label. You know, what were those early days like? I mean, you say it was a grind, obviously in your latter half, I can imagine, because we're all similar in age where you kind of have to think more realistically. But in those early ages, were you just kind of, you know, was it all very gradual and just kind of coming together, and you guys were young enough knowing that it wasn't really a financial responsibility and more of a, I don't want to say hobby, but you know what I mean?
Oh, it was totally a hobby. I mean, that was, I guess for us, we just took it so seriously. It was like all we did every single day after school. That was it. Monday through Friday, it was like treated it like jobs, you know? We were determined to be an incredible live band, and just, you had to put so much time into it. I mean, also that young, like you're still learning your instruments.
Right.
So it's like, if you're not putting that kind of time into it, like you're just not going to get there. Like, I think a lot of people, you was either that, or you'd be like in your bedroom, like trying to figure things out too. Like at 16 years old, like I think what I'd been playing guitar for like 3 years or something. So I think it was necessary to really figure things out and get to a place where like by the age of 20, 21, we were like barely decent at our instruments. But no, it is like, I mean, I guess I'm 39 now, and it's crazy how fast like time flies.
Yeah. It's interesting to me is you're similar in age to us. We're 35, 36, and you were playing shows with all these bands that we were like discovering as friends. Like yeah. You were out actually touring with those bands. That's crazy to me.
No, it's wild. I'll show you, because I keep it here. It's like the only like music thing I have in my little home office here.
But it pertains- sounds like nerdery to me.
Oh, yeah.
I have this like backstage pass from a radio show in the year 2000.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
That's see awesome. The lineup that's on it.
Pennywise, Incubus, Deftones, Papa Roach, Head P, Face to Face, Phoenix TX, 8-Stop-7, Linkin Park. I love how low Linkin Park is on that list.
Yeah, and there's, you know, we were just kind of getting our start, you can see.
Yeah. Chronic Future.
But that was like, for us, that was like, I mean, that was a huge moment for us. And that was a couple of years still before Lines in My Face. Like this was the show actually where we met our manager, who really was responsible for getting us on Interscope. And I think like kind of taking us to another level, really. It was Face to Face's manager, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Who wound up, like, obviously started a label called Vagrant Records. And we were able to really, he was in a really great moment in time with that scene in that wave of bands, and was able to really leverage a lot of that, I think, into helping us get on Interscope and have some of the small successes that we had.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Funk Junkies. I didn't know they were regionally from your area, but like I grew up with that Infected album, Fear of a Whack Planet, and I can definitely see a little of that. Like, was that like the Scottsdale Phoenix sound at the time?
Definitely.
Yeah.
100%. It was just crazy. Like, Phoenix had like the very interesting underground kind of like warehouse scene going on. And Funk Junkies were definitely like the super exciting band, especially when we were like 13 or 14 years old. We worshiped it. I'd never seen anything like it before. It's funny, like I listen to it now and I'm like, it's not the same as what I was when I was 13 years old, but like it was definitely a special time.
Like that song, What the Fuck, Chuck?
Exactly.
Doesn't hit the same at almost 40.
No.
13, it's like literally one of the coolest things you ever heard. I mean, and that's the thing. I was like, our early record, they were super young too when they made that stuff. But when we were like 13 or 14, like our first records, like we just wanted to be like them. Like we thought they were, you know, of course we all worshipped 311 as well. And, you know, Beast Boys were definitely like the best, my favorite band. Still are my favorite artists to this day.
So what you're saying is we would have hung out in high school.
Sounds like
a lot of the same stuff, and would have gone to see. I mean, we saw 311 when they came up our way, any chance we could, and small venue didn't matter. Yeah,
I think that was the thing too. Like for us, and I don't know. I think it probably had a lot to do with why we sort of got a little disinterested in moving forward and even like After Lines in My Face is like our music taste changed so much from those days. Those are the things we were listening to when we were like 13, 14, 15 years old. But when I was 23, which is like about how old, like Lines in My Face, I think we made, we were like 22, 23. I was like really deep diving into like stuff like The Cure and like pretty deep, like indie records and electronic music and weird experimental stuff like Aphex Twin. And like, you know, just wasn't really interested in like that. Like musically, I wasn't that interested, frankly, in making music necessarily like what we were doing right in that moment at that time. Like we had gotten to that point and I loved doing all of it, but I think all of us also were like a little bit like stuck doing a style that we sort of were growing out of, I would say. Looking back on it, I love all that stuff now. Like I'm so nostalgic for a lot of the, like, that scene, and like I go back and I listen to like that kind of like a lot of the music that was of that era all the time. But I just sort of hit a place musically, I'd say creatively, where I was really interested in like everything that like we were not necessarily doing musically. I think all of us were in that same zone.
I think that happened to a lot of people at that time frame too, though, right? I mean, because as you said, the timing was kind of off for Lines in My Face, where had it come out in 2000,
exactly.
You know what I mean? Like it might have been a different story.
Yeah, we would have been Incubus or something.
Right. Yeah. It's crazy. Timing is everything, as they say. But it's still an awesome record, and I'm friends with Nate and Tuan for Nate introduced me to our buddy Rob, who worked at the radio station, and they got me into you guys around that time too. And we were all just like, how is this not huge? Like this just needs to be on the radio everywhere. There's four singles that we think on this. You know what I mean? It was one of those situations.
Yeah. It never caught at alternative radio. TV loved us, and we had this like summer where they play the video of Time and Time Again like constantly, and it took us to another level. I think that's really where a lot of people heard about us, and that summer was so much fun. Like we had worked so hard all of our lives, and suddenly like, you know, we were in New York, we were like people, you know, our video was one of the top played videos between MTV and MTV2 that summer, and it just never really connected at alternative radio. I think it like peaked at like the mid-30s and never could really get it going again. I remember at the time feeling super bummed about that. But it's funny, like now that I've like worked in music for so long, and I've sort of like can just sort of seen like the curtain behind, like behind the curtain of Oz, like I've seen Oz or whatever. You just come to realize like it just wasn't our time. Like there's so many great records made and great bands out there that never had their due. And I would actually go as far as to say like, we were super lucky and had an awesome run. Like I had so much fun. Like still got, I played music with my best friends. I got to see the entire planet a couple times over. And I got like a great start, frankly, in the career that I have today that's been like super rewarding. And that frankly, like my best connections in music today are the same people that I met back in the day. You know, I met Fred Feldman, who told me about the post that you guys made in a basement show in Long Island in 2002, you know, and like, I think of him as like a mentor now. So
we got to ask you, what was the basement show? Tuan, I know you're peaked. who did you see where you met Fred Feldman?
I met him the dressing room was in the basement. The show was the Crazy Donkey, I think, in Farmingdale, which was like, the bands was, North Star and Monine.
Well, you want to know something funny? Was North Star was my pick for the episode that we featured you on.
Fred Feldman. Fred Feldman made the connection.
Oh, that's what it was. Yeah, because they were Triple Crown. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good tour. Like, that was an interesting tour. It was fun.
So I'm curious. So it's late 90s. You're in the Scottsdale Phoenix scene, and you get connected with, I think you said, the founder of Vagrant Records, right? How did that, like, did he just stumble upon you guys, or was he a friend? And then how did that translate to Interscope? Was it like Label Showcase? Like, because you always see like
totally
in the movies, they fly someone out and it's a club show and you gotta.
It's actually about, it's a good story because it's definitely 100% that cliche that you just like almost spelled it out perfectly already. Let me just try, I'll give you the most condensed version of it. So Face to Face and Chronic Future, the second record deal that we signed was with a label called Beyond Music, kind of a short-lived label venture through VMG. I think we signed this when we were like 17 or 18 years old. We face-to-face also shared this label, and we had played a show with them, with the Funk Junkies. It was like a New Year's Eve show, 1996. It was Chronic Future. We were like the opening act, and Funk Junkies and face-to-face support. That's how big Funk Junkies were in Phoenix at the time. They all flew out for the show because it was New Year's Eve, and Rich, who was face-to-face's manager and went on to start Vagrant, was out in Phoenix at the time, and they saw us play, and we were just little kids playing this 2000 capacity show, and like the guys in face-to-face just like really loved us, and I think just were like super encouraging to us, and like very nice, and like, you know, it was definitely a good feeling for us. But Rich caught that set. I guess we were like memorable enough to them to where when we played this show here that I just pointed the pass out to, they watched our set, and we at this time were sharing a record label together. They were also on Beyond Music, and I guess they had just been having a really rough go at it. Beyond was run by a pretty like heavy music manager named Alan Kovac, who managed like Motley Crue at the time and is like still around. I think he like looks after like Papa Roach and stuff like that to this day. But you know, it was a kind of a horrible place to be as a band. Like they really were having no successes. It wasn't a lot of support for artists. It was as bad of a label as you could probably dream up, that was Beyond Music. And Rich and Trevor, I guess, the way they told the story to us, they were getting on an airplane after they had played, and Trevor was saying to Rich, you know, like, we're fine. Like we have our careers, like we can just move on from Beyond Music. But people I really feel bad for, I feel bad for those kids. Like those kids are just going to be trapped on this label. Like we got to help them out here. And so Rich kind of gave us a call, gave us the lowdown about, we talked about kind of the bad situation that was Beyond Music. And he agreed to be our manager. I think really, because they just like, they really liked what we were doing. But I think he also, there was like a charitable side where he just was like, we got to get these kids out of here. We got to help these kids get out. And so Rich took us on. And from that point forward, he started really, you know, Trevor from Face to Face, the singer, was like, they both really like gave us a lot of encouragement, a lot of like, I think that's where we went from our second record and had a lot of exposure to these really amazing musicians and other scenes that really sort of lent themselves to like what we, the sort of styles and influences that we took on almost in those years. And so as Rich started guiding us, we started demoing a lot of stuff out, and Vagrant became a very, very successful label in those years. That was like kind of the rise of like Dashboard Confessional and Alkaline Trio and Get Up Kids and
Saves the
number
Day.
Of those. Saves the Day. Exactly. Saves the Day was like a band who really took us on tour a lot as well early on. And I would say showed us a lot of records and again, gave us a lot of encouragement as this like rap rock band that we could meld these other super melodic, interesting styles, like, you know, listening to like Beach Boys records and Pet Sounds and stuff like that and saying like, no, like you can, we can make this sophisticated, like we can do this. And so Rich started like literally shopping us around, and Vagrant was having a lot of success at the time. So there were a lot of labels paying attention to him. And one of those labels was Interscope. They were really investing in a lot what like Rich was doing at the time. And we got a call one day that, you know, Rich had played our music for Jimmy Iovine. And it was like exactly what you said. Like we're on flights 3 days later to play at the Viper Room, where we like walked into this, we like flew into LA, like went straight to the Viper Room where there was like replicas of our equipment waiting for us, and like waited 10 minutes for Jimmy and Rich to get there. And there was like these two bar stools like in the center of the room. And we played one song, we played Time and Time Again. And then, you know, Jimmy like thought it was great when we finished the first song, and he's like, play me another one. And we launched in the second song, and like a minute into it, he like stopped us. He's like, I've seen enough, thank you. And he like left. And then Rich called us that night, and they sent us an offer. That's how we sent.
Wow.
That's crazy. I always wonder what it's like to be the guy that's like, yeah, yeah, halfway through that second song, yeah, that's enough, I'm good, see ya. I'm just gonna bounce. Don't finish it.
You have to go get dinner with his kids, you know?
I mean, they're seeing a million things a day, I'm sure, but it's funny to me. It's like, let them finish the song at least.
It shows the trade spend that was around back then. Fly them out, play a song. All right, I'm good here. I got to catch a dinner. And it's like, everything's expensed. Totally. You know, it's like, damn.
No, never happened to that. You know, they made us keep demoing stuff out for a long time. And they finally, at one point, I guess they really felt like we had like enough and gave us the resources to make Lines in My Face. We spent 7 months in LA making that record, just living together and working with our producer, Sean Bevan. Recorded the drums at Sunset Sound and then spent probably 5 months at his house in Laurel Canyon.
You were already heading into that sound then. It sounds like with Time and Time Again, and it wasn't a ton of label pressure to do something a little more like that. You were kind of already headed that way.
Oh, totally. Yeah. No, there was no one really there. The A&R like kind of came in once we had all the songs written and helped us like plug us with producers and like the people to make the albums, but we were really left alone to write the songs. I don't think they cared that much.
Really? Wow.
No, I mean, look, we weren't like this high priority, like signing. Like, I think they just got to a place where they just, we wrote a couple songs that they felt like had a shot. And, you know, Eminem was there at the time. Like a lot of their, interestingly enough, Eminem's hype man, there's a guy named Proof who actually passed away a few years ago. He was not murdered. He was killed, unfortunately, in a fight. But Proof was coming out to Phoenix a lot in those days. And we were friends with a lot of people in the local hip hop community in Phoenix and wound up sort of having all these like mutual friends in Eminem's crew. So it kind of started making a lot of connections for us also within Interscope, and the people that made, the director that made the Time and Time Again video also made an Eminem video as well. These are called like Guerrilla News Network is like the crew that like made these animations. But once we had that video in hand, which was actually all Jimmy Iovine's idea, you know, to connect to what was going on with the Iraq war at the time to the song itself, and the message of the song. And I think it really resonated on a visual level, which is why I think MTV picked it up and actually it had the run that it did.
Yeah, it kind of speaks to what's going on today too, right? So it's a little, it's timeless totally. In a sense.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I mean, I live in New York now, but my first exposure really was like in the year of like 2004 when, I mean, there was a convention taking place, and I remember like being on the protests, like in the protests, like as like an 18-year-old, and it was, yeah, that was like my first connection even to New York City, but it's like small potatoes to what's happening now.
That's crazy. I mean, you said it seems like they let you guys be somewhat autonomous. There was no label pressure on make a song like this. Like we had, I don't know if you know the band Zebrahead.
Totally, yeah.
We had Greg on, a guitarist, and he had a great story about the label, kind of another cliche story, you know what I mean? Like the producer is like, that's good, but what we really need is a Sugar Ray fly. In other words, we need something super radio friendly, not about war, not about things that are controversial, just something that gets spins and sells records. There was nothing like that at all.
It's so funny to think of that too, because like Sugar Ray, we played so many shows with Sugar Ray back in the day.
Yeah.
When they were just like on their first album, Fly was nothing. It was not the Sugar Ray that I knew. I knew them as like a hardcore band.
Yeah.
And Mark McGrath was literally this guy that would like, anytime we performed a show with him, he'd like 100% would be like on ecstasy, fully naked, pumping like the sound guy, making jokes about how small Chronic Future's dicks were because we were like 14 years old. And that's why I remember his favorite joke was that he liked to say that he liked to play with Chronic Future because we were the only guys whose dicks were smaller than his own.
Oh, we were like man.
We were little kids. It was that level of, he would have been canceled today.
Oh, that's amazing.
But no, I did not. Fly was nothing like the band that I knew. We didn't have that experience though. No, we were like, I think if anything, they really pushed, like Jimmy Iovine's the kind of executive that like, he wanted us to be controversial. He wanted us to be like, if we were like pushing those envelopes or like making political statements, he was totally supportive of it. And no,
yeah, actually makes sense.
Fully supported in that way. I mean, this was the time, I mean, Eminem was on the label at the time. He had Nine Inch Nails, like anything that was controversial was on Interscope. Marilyn Manson.
That's kind of a dream. It's kind of a dream for you guys then, right? You don't have to worry about the label pressure per se, and you're able to make the music you want to make. Even if maybe you're changing tastes, you know, individually at that point, you're able to at least come together and do your thing and not be told, go this way, go that way.
Totally. No, it was we were super lucky in that way. I don't think we would have responded well to that other also. Like, we would have just probably never, we would have never gotten that far in that situation. We were like, I think in those days though, like, it's funny to hear that Zebrahead story, because I, for the most part, most of the bands that I knew of in that era were always kind of left alone to their own devices. And you sort of, I felt like what the process was more like was that you demoed until they deemed something to be worthy of a shot. But I never felt like they were like getting in our heads in terms of like what to write or like exactly what they wanted, like descriptive briefs or whatever in that way. It was more just like, that'll work.
That's yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Well, you bring up a good point, because it's Interscope and all the artists that you just mentioned are controversial. So that's almost like their, you know, their niche or whatever. But I think of Zebrahead, they were on Columbia, which is Sony. Mm-hmm. And Sony was notorious for trying to steer things in a certain direction, right? Like, there's, I can't remember the band, but they even put out an album that said "Suck Phony," which is "Fuck Sony," basically.
Yeah, those you know, especially, yeah.
Yeah, so it might be a label flavor in itself. So another luck strike with Interscope. So,
I think no, we were in the right place at the right time for sure with our record in terms of a label home.
You mentioned Sean Bevan. Was that the first time you worked with a producer? Because like, it's funny, some of the stories you hear of different producers where they take on like the fifth member, sixth member of the band, and then some it's like artists try to stiff arm them away from the creative process, you know what I mean? How was that, was that different for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, he definitely really honed in on like the arrangements of the songs themselves, and I think that was able to keep was a huge part in the I think he was really responsible, I would say, for the balance that exists on Lines in My Face between some of the more esoteric sounds that you hear occurring, especially in some of the interludes, versus like what we were doing on more of like the straightforward records themselves. You know, like a song like Thank You or whatever, New York, I think is a good example of him really helping us hone in on just keeping things really simple and catchy.
And I mean, that album is, it's catchy. There's some, just some great intro, some great guitar riffs. The whole thing is just awesome.
We were like, our mission was we were going for the jugular with every single section. Like yeah. there is like no section left like unthought out. There is everything is really meticulously crafted, I would say. We spent awesome. seven months making that thing.
That's awesome.
At the time, where did you guys, like, what did you guys think of yourselves as a band in terms of like, would you think yourselves more on like the new metal Papa Roach side, or more of like, you know, the Zebrahead pop punk?
It's so funny. I mean, I'll tell you this, when we were making Lines in My Face, we hated everything like that. We hated them all. We thought it was all cheesy. We were super bummed. I think there was like a level of look, we were like touring with Saves the Day, and we're like, our friends were all the bands that were like in that sort of scene. And like, we sort of we despised Fred Durst. Like, we hated that shit. We liked it. We were into that 5-6 years prior, you know, like we felt like what they were doing, like we were interested in it, but we were little kids at that point. But by the times we were like, so when we went in to make Lines in My Face, like I would say our mission was to completely separate ourselves from all of it. We knew that that was what our sound was. We knew that that's like what the expectation of us was. If we'd had the chance to start with a clean slate and go make like melodic indie rock records or whatever, we would have done it. But we were smart enough to know that that would have never worked. So I think Lines in My Face is like, we were going to make our version of like what that could be in a sophisticated way. And like, we were on a mission with that album to do something very different. We wanted to be Radiohead. Like, that's who we worshiped at that time.
Nice.
And Bjork. Yeah. That like we were, that's the stuff we were listening to.
And I think that's probably why whenever I've tried to explain you guys to someone, I can't pigeonhole it. Cause there really isn't, like, I could say, yeah, it's got some elements of this, it's got some elements of that, but it's kind of a really awesome, throw all that into a blender, amalgamation of that stuff.
Yeah.
And it came out, you know, it's got that nice glossy Interscope sound to it too. And it just worked out, but there was never any way that I could just say, yeah, no, they're like this band, check them out. No, there's elements of stuff, but it's not, there was all kinds of different things.
Thanks. No, we were definitely on that mission. I think too, just, I don't know. We just, you know, I go back to Radiohead. Like, we just, that we really were trying to figure out how to weave in a lot of that experimental stuff into like what we were doing. But no, I appreciate you calling that out. it was interesting to like think of where we were going to go, because there was no way we were going to make anything. We were, I don't know. It was like, it's just, I don't know where we would have gone musically after that. You know, there was a lot of demos written and stuff, but like, I think the problem for us wasn't necessarily like the studio or like the creative aspect. I think if we had gotten back together, we would have found a way to make something that we loved recording wise. We really didn't have a place to tour anymore. Didn't really, even though our friends were bands like Saves the Day and, you know, a lot of vagrant artists I was naming, the tours never really worked for us like that. They weren't like, we weren't great fits with those bands. And then when we would go on tour with like Papa Roach or Trust Company, it was so ungratifying for us. Their fan base was just, they were there to just like kick the shit out of each other. And like, it was sort of like this sort of, I guess, active rock crowd, especially when we were touring through a lot of the middle American states. It just wasn't satisfying to us, like in terms of like what we were trying to do. And, you know, it's not like the shows, we didn't have like energy or we didn't get response from them, but I'd never felt like they were like, what the response was not necessarily being reciprocated because they were like loving our music. It was because we played like with enough energy that they could just like, you know, just, you know, kick the shit out of each other or whatever. But I don't know. It wasn't gratifying to play for Papa Roach Kids. Like it just wasn't our thing.
That's interesting. Coming from the fan aspect, you know, us on the other side watching the show, one segment we almost did was like, you know, the most interesting or strange like concert or festival lineups you ever saw. And that one I was going to bring up was Van Halen, RIP Eddie, Cool and the Gang opened. And it was like such a weird split personality where it's like, okay, and then now this. But as a fan of music, you're like all about it. That's actually why we made this podcast, because we're fans of all music. And actually, well, Chronic Future fits this program perfectly because it's a hybrid of everything, right?
I would say like the band that survived it all, the one that we still just always like respected and I still respect because of the longevity they've had, is those Deftones. I just feel like they've always found a way to just like make high art throughout, even though I would say that their contemporaries are just not at that level whatsoever. They never really fit in, but they figured out how to create, forge their own path in a way that we certainly didn't.
They're our house band here. They're our one of our favorites.
They're incredible. I mean, they still are making great music.
That's awesome. In terms of marketing differences, we were doing some deep digging and saw that you guys had a MySpace page that was attached to the website and whatnot. Was that kind of almost like a de facto website? Obviously you guys came up in the, you know, mid 90s, early 90s to 2004 with Lines in My Face. Somewhere? That was
there. I have to see it. Is it up somewhere?
I don't think it's up. Yeah. I don't think it comes up, but.
Man, I have to see that. I think I made that website.
that was like the de facto website back then, right? I mean, everybody middle 2000s.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. That was kind of like the last days for us, like in terms of, I remember like putting our stuff up on MySpace and like thinking how cool it was that you could just have a player like that.
Who would have been in your top eight back then?
Oh man. Well, Face to Face, Saves the Day. Oh man. Probably a lot of different Phoenix things, like Back to the NTED, who was a big part of the making of Lines in My Face, like in terms of the electronics and stuff like that. He was an artist that we would have definitely had in our top eight in those days. Oh my gosh. Who else would have been? There's a band in Phoenix that we were friends with called Opiate for the Masses. They would have been likely in the top eight just because they were our friends. Oh man, that's a hard question at like that exact moment in time. How many have I named there?
Five or six. So yeah, that's good. Tom would have been in your top eight because he's in everybody's top eight. So.
See, Tom had the best idea out of everybody. Like Tom's out living his best life right now. He's checked out. He's got his money. He's living.
So. That time frame is also big internet piracy, right? So did you hear of any like leaking of the album prior to, or do you feel like that might have cut into what you guys were doing?
No, everyone was playing on the same field. You know, everyone was dealing with the same thing. I honestly thought, I still think like that stuff, like it only helped artists, you know, in those days. It set up streaming, which I think is actually the long tail that a lot of artists too like can play on. That nostalgia has actually created a whole new source of revenue for a lot of these people who like maybe who are lucky enough to even have their own masters back or whatever. The simple fact that like that one CD point of purchase with the CD wasn't like the only like way that they could get paid. Now there's this like way of like, if you have a base of audience that listens to you every single month, you know, those pennies definitely add up for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So I'm all about streaming and whatever, like however we got there is like good by me.
Yeah. I mean, because a dedicated fan that's continuously listening to it, they're basically generating more revenue than what a single CD would have generated, right?
Completely. Yeah. Over time, certainly.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's convenient, right? You can bring it everywhere. I mean, I played your record Lines in My Face like 3 times in the last like 4 days. So.
Well, that's awesome.
There you go.
Thank you.
Speaking of different ways of music kind of getting out there, it looks like you had music, some of your music on soundtracks and TV shows too. Was that all through the label or was that, how did that work?
We signed, so at the same time we signed to Interscope, we also signed a publishing deal with Universal, and they had a really great team of people there that were like doing early music syncs. I think that was definitely a big part of it. What was the show? There was a few shows that definitely picked up our stuff that were super helpful.
So that the Lines in My Face comes and goes, you guys leave Interscope, you've done some stuff sporadically here and there, but that was kind of the end of Chronic Future.
Yeah, it's funny, like we never really talked about it. Like it's just sort of like the years went, like 1 year turned to 2 years and we hadn't put anything out and it just sort of fizzled out. And I think none of us had the interest like at that point to put like the energy that we really needed to put into like do what we needed to do. And we're doing like all those years. Just don't know how like sustainable it was for us too. You know, like I think we were all sick of being broke at that point. Like we just needed to like find other means and find other avenues to set ourselves up to like just be able to survive really.
It reminds me of, I don't know if you know the band Blacklisted, but they have a line that's, I put my life on the shelf while everyone around me found happiness and wealth, and it's about touring.
Totally.
I think you see a lot of that where whether you grow out of it or for financial reasons, it's not sustainable. But it sounds like that might have been part of it.
Oh, 100%. I mean, when you're coming home and it's like you've made $1,000, you know, you get your like $250 when it's over. It's not enough to live, you know? Again, like, I just think that's, you know, we were sort of one of like the eras of like bands being able to make it for a really long time. It's not really meant to be like that. Like it's supposed, I think being in a band in a lot of ways is supposed to be like a photograph of kind of like an era of time. If you're lucky to like survive a few decades, like that's incredible. That you really, for people to be able to hold it together that long and make that kind of sacrifice together, I think is, you know, you're lucky if you can really pull that off.
Yeah, well said. The way you framed it is my head went to kind of where my career kind of ebbed and flowed. We were talking about earlier. It's like I used to make alcohol, like in the production side, and I was like, this is awesome. This is cool. Like I'm having a blast. But same thing. I'm not making any money. This is brutal. You know, blue collar work, and it's. I think I liked the passion behind it, but it wasn't really going to pay the bills and it really wasn't something I was seeing the longevity in. So I went into the sales and marketing aspect and still in it today. So I did that transition too. Was that kind of how you transitioned into more of the artist management? You knew you still wanted to stay in it, but you wanted to be on the other side of the fence?
Yeah, I mean, I love music. I'd be like, I like live and die. I like, I just, it's everything in my life. So yeah, it just sort of naturally happened. And when I saw that I could really make a difference for young artists, especially like I was like turning like 27, 28 years old and starting to work with like 18 and 19 year olds myself. There were a lot of things that happened in my career that I would have just done a lot differently, or like, you know, like having that hindsight, I felt like I could actually be a really effective manager. And, you know, I started having a lot of artists that I was working with started having a lot more success than I found as an artist myself. So it just kind of clicked for me. And I was really lucky that happened. And I mean, it's really like, it's really blossomed for me even in like this later period of my life. And I feel like it's for me aging, is like an aging, you know, music lover, like, you know, 40 as a manager, like feels pretty good. You know, like I feel like, you know, if I was 40 years old, still trying to tour, like, I don't even know. I can't imagine that life, to be honest with you. I don't want to be the old guy at the bar. I'll be like the old guy at my old guy bar, but you know, like,
yeah, totally.
I think there's a thing too. It's like you're either lucky enough to where your band continues to progress to where it like makes sense for you to be 40 and playing at the arena or at like a 2,000 cap venue. But, you know, I think that for us, like, you know, we kind of topped out at club shows and, you know, there's only so much you can do and there's so many ways you can travel and like circumstances of like, you know, being in a van every single day and splitting two like Motel 6 rooms. Like, you know, there's, you can only do that for like 10 years, I'd say, before it gets, you know, you got to start thinking about other options.
Yeah, it makes total sense. The responsibilities that come with it, starting a family, being away from home, like you said, sleeping on the floor or whatever in a van, like it comes with the age. So the fact that you got started so early is actually really great because you got the best of both worlds, right?
Oh, totally. No, we played music festivals in front of tens of thousands of people. Like we were able to really, like we traveled the world. Like it was, you know, it was definitely a great gift for us to be able to do that. And no regrets in that sense.
So you, you're doing the Teamwork Records thing now. Can you explain that a little bit?
So I work for, yeah. So, Teamwork's actually a management company.
Management, sorry,
we,
yes.
We do both management and we have a record label as well. But yeah, I've been now at Teamwork for a number of years. We represent like a pretty wide range of clients, everything from like Major Lazer and Diplo to Sturgill Simpson to Animal Collective and TV on the Radio to Yellow Days and wide range of stuff. And yeah, no, it's funny, a lot of the people I work with today, like kind of who are my age, are like still people that I had met back in the day when I was in a band myself. We were all just doing different things.
Yeah, it seems like it's a natural progression. Like a lot of former sports ball players are now either analysts or coaches, and it's just like
totally
who better to be involved?
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
That's exactly. It's a good point. So the world kind of, I mean, look, it's kind of it. I think it's a lot easier when you've been on the road to then look an artist in the face and say like, no, you like. I know it seems like a stretch to do the two shows in a row, but like, just like, let's do these two and you can have 3 days off here or whatever. Like I've done it. It seems impossible, but like, you'll get through this. Yeah. I think it goes a long way when you like can speak from that experience versus like someone who might not have had that, might not be able to come from the same place and, you know, have that kind of trust level with someone who's like in the middle of it.
I think you said it, trust. It's like going to a restaurant and like you see someone flipping out on the waitress or the waiter. And you're like, man, clearly that person's never worked in a restaurant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's just what it comes down to. It's like, you don't know that stress. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of remembering. And so, someone's flipping out on you as a customer. It's like, you've never worked in a restaurant. You don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. So
100%.
It's too bad.
I was just going to say, is there anything that you miss about being in a band? Like,
oh, I missed the 45 minutes on stage. Totally.
Yep.
Like that was the best. It was just every other hour that sucked.
Fair. A lot went into that, those 45 minutes then.
I love performing and like, you know, I'm going to take that back. We had so much fun together. Like we weren't a band that had like big fights or anything. Like we're still best friends to this day. Like we still have like our group chat and like that we talk on like almost every day. Like it's, you know, we literally just like laughed all of the, like wherever we were like literally making jokes and laughing at every stupid inside joke possible that we had. So it, but no, I don't miss, like I miss that. And I miss, the thing is like, we still laugh. So that still exists.
That's great.
I miss performing. I loved performing.
So what you're trying to say is a reunion is in store.
We had a reunion. So that was the thing. We had our 20 year reunion a couple of years ago and it was great. And it was like, it couldn't be like a better, like not ruling out something like some other day, but you know, having had all those years where we never really like looked at each other and were like, okay, like it's over or whatever, like it just sort of, we just knew after like a certain amount of years that it wasn't going to happen again, even though we were still like hanging out all the time. We wound up doing, we could like, you know, we recognized that our 20 year anniversary was coming up, and so we did a show here in New York City at Bowery Ballroom, and then we, after that, like, that went really well, and then we decided to have a final show at what was the first venue that we ever played in Phoenix. We like almost 20 years to that date, we did that venue, and we're just like, that's the way to end it.
Nice.
That's awesome. I got a little quick story about Bowery Ballroom, which is completely unrelated to everything, but shows that it's New York City. I lived there back in the day, and I had my ID and the licenses from Maine back in the day. It was just probably maybe any license from any state back in the day was
ours,
like this piece
ours
of paper.
Notoriously bad though.
Yeah, a piece of paper and it's laminated, so it looks like a fake ID. So I got dragged out like cartoon style out of the club at a Bowery Ballroom. Yeah, and I was like, no, it's a real ID, and they took it and everything, which is illegal. Oh, but
that sucks.
But, yeah, great venue.
Ours were bad. The Maine IDs back in the early 2000s were really a joke.
No, I still like I kept my Arizona ID for a long time, and the expiration date is 2045 on it, and people are just
wow.
2045, really?
You look just like that person.
Those final shows were really great for us, and like it was kind of awesome to see like people still turning out to see us, and it was super cool for us to do. And also just like cool, I think for me, like I, you know, like for me to like show my clients that I could actually still like
nice, yeah. You still got it, guys.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's awesome. You know, something I just thought of with the whole reunion thing, is that all you guys? Is there a third party, you know, management or management friend that's like, hey, we're getting a lot of inquiries on you guys coming back together?
That was me.
Okay. Yeah. I was always wondering about that because you know, I'm here in San Diego, so you know, brush shoulders with some people and they're like, yeah, man, like Scott Russo, for instance, from Unwritten Law. He's like, they get paid like pretty much their whole year salary from just doing one tour in Australia because the demand's so big over there. You know,
that's awesome. I wish I wonder. Have that.
No, yeah.
No. That's good for them though.
I wonder if we could start Kickstarters for bands that we want to see back together and like yeah. have it be.
I mean, 21 Pilots definitely owes us some money.
Yeah, right.
Like, whatever though.
Yeah.
I'll just throw that out there.
Well, I mean, everything is a recycle of something old, right?
That was kind of what like spawned it for us, because when they came out, we started getting hit up by a lot of different people just being like, have you heard of this? Like, they're literally like sounds just like Chronic Future. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't know what you mean. Like, and I like finally got around to listening to them and was like, totally yeah. like, and I mean, I'll take that as a compliment.
Hell yeah, man. Hell yeah.
So Ben, with all our guests, we do kind of a lightning round at the end of our episodes. And it's really just kind of quick hitter questions. And I'm curious, we call anything that's a collectible or physical good, like an item of nerdery. Like music nerdery.
Nerdery, got it.
We're all music nerds. Curious of what your favorite piece is. I know you showed us that lanyard. Anything else?
My nerdery. My Warped Tour pass from 2004, for sure.
Nice.
Yeah, nice.
Awesome. How was that then?
Yeah. You probably both were there, right?
Yeah.
How were you there too?
Depends on what date, but yeah.
I just love hearing guests say nerdery. It makes my day. I'm not going to lie to you guys. Like, yes, it's catching on. Even if we're making you say it, it's still catching on.
Nerdery, it's great. I'm going to use it.
Yeah, we've had a few things come up. Spin, what is it? Spin value.
Spin value, yeah. We were talking about.
I mean, you could be dealing with like any artist in the world you deal with. Like, they look, you know, you might think they're like super cool, whatever. They're all fucking nerds.
Yeah, so are we.
The only way you get really, really good at something is to be nerdy at it deep yes. inside.
Totally. Yes.
Absolutely.
Totally. One of your, okay, so you did kind of talk through a little bit of your touring history. What was your favorite bill you were on?
It has to be the pass that I just showed you. It's probably why I keep it out. Nice. Like, if that festival existed today, it'd be massive.
It'd be bonkers. Like, oh my god. Yeah. We'd be flying out to go see it right now.
Yeah, it's impossible to put something like that together. I mean, we definitely played with some, you know, really I'd say like important bands or like interesting places in time. You know, like I remember playing like tiny club shows with, you know, bands like My Chemical Romance or whatever, that like just they would never be in a venue that small again. And then I'd say I think the most, like, for me, like, legendary band in my book that we played with, that we were lucky enough to share a stage with, was this band called Snot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I would say, like, their singer passing away before they, you know, really could have their day in the sun was pretty tragic. But, yeah.
That was super early for you guys, too, right? Like, 96, 97?
Oh, God. Maybe 99, okay, 98. Yeah. No, yeah, maybe you're right. You're right. It was probably 96, 97.
Yeah, that would make sense. I think Lynn passed in 97 or 98.
Wow.
I think you're right.
Crazy. Yeah, we did shows with them and Seven Dust.
Nice. We're huge fans of all those bands, you know? And we were making fun of, like, the new metal thing with, you know, like Fred Durst, for instance, or whatever. And there's a lot of, like, taboo things with new metal, but there's a lot of good stuff in there. And Seven Dust, I feel like, doesn't really fit the new metal bill. You know, LeJean can legit sing, you know, which is great.
For sure. For sure. No, it's funny. Like, so my friends and I, like a couple of my colleagues as well, like all loves one of my best friends in the music business who, you know, he's like signed like some really major artists over the last couple of years. We like joke about how like he's fully into new metal. He's this dude from Michigan. And like, I mean, he convinced me. We were like sitting outside like the other day and we were talking and like he's like, dude, you just won't believe, he's like, I know you won't believe this, but most underrated new metal album is the first Stained record. Fuck off. That's cheesy as, like, no, that is, there's no way Stained holds up. Like, not possible. We can talk about White Pony all day. I'll fuck around with the first Limp Bizkit record and have a laugh, but fuck the first Stained record. And so like we get in the car and I'm like, right, Mud Shovel is, and like honestly, like I listen to that shit like every day now. Like, it's I so love good.
You gotta check out their record before that, which was Tormented.
Okay.
It's back down. When they were playing like local underground clubs in Boston area.
I think he was telling me about this too.
And it's like really, it's really raw and really good.
Now Aaron Lewis is a country star. What happened?
Find a way to sustain.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
I was gonna say, tired of sleeping on floors, and yeah, I need to pay the bills.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Ben, one thing I'm curious about is I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. You're 16, 17 in the late 90s. Things are starting to pop off. It's really kind of pre-internet as we know it. So how did you guys get to shows? I mean, did you have a parent or?
Oh yeah, our parents were super supportive and just dropped us off at every club show we wanted to go to. Yeah, totally. Wow. I saw every, and that was the thing. We were like show rats. Like we went to everything. Hip hop shows. I was at like De La Soul shows. I saw Beastie Boys like three times in those days. It was crazy. I would never let my kid go to the shows I was going to by myself. We were all like, our parents were all like fully divorced, like dealing with their own shit when we were like 13. So we kind of like lucked out and just like, they're just like, get out, just go.
I can relate to that a little bit, not gonna lie.
Yeah, especially cool. Going to every show. I mean, in Maine in the winter, there's nothing else to do.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, that's it.
It's just cold here. Yep.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, there's something to stay there. Let's go. There's something to the asylum. Let's go. It's inside. Yeah. So we, well, Ben, we really want to thank you for coming on tonight.
No, I appreciate really cool, you guys. Thanks awesome for remembering us.
Oh, hell yeah.
This was really fun. You've been a fantastic guest and some of the stories had us really laughing. We'll listen back to this and have another good laugh.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you guys. Thank you so much.
So that was our interview with Ben Collins, guitarist and vocalist of the 90s and 2000s band Chronic Future. Guys, that was a kick-ass interview. Ben was awesome. I knew we'd get a good interview. Just, you know, sometimes you can get a vibe with a band, like, a band like Chronic Future, you know, doesn't have any stiffs in the band. You know what I mean? Like, they're probably upbeat people and interesting people. I got that vibe coming in, and he solidified it. I think it was a great interview.
Yeah, I agree. Just really easy to talk to, energetic, friendly, smiling. No, like, ego where we're, like, feeling like we're walking on eggshells or something like that. I agree with you, Tuan, 100%.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. He had some cool stories about coming up bands. I mean, you'll see a picture on the YouTube this week, bands that they played with early on, bands that they toured with throughout, you know, the major label experience versus being a 16-year-old in his hometown, kind of with a job that was being in a band. Interesting perspective from Ben. And I thoroughly enjoyed talking to him. And that Mark McGrath story was funny as hell.
That was awesome. Yeah, totally. I mean, and obviously you just heard the interview, so we got into it, but I'd love to put myself in his shoes of, like, you know, you grow up with your best friends. I mean, the time frame when I met you guys was similar to when they started. Like, can you imagine starting a band in, like, Nate, your basement, and then you go sell out local shows of, like, you know, a couple hundred cap, and then it keeps getting bigger, and you're playing shows with Face to Face and Funk Junkies and 2,000 room cap. And yeah, I mean, even for us, like, we had a lot of similar music interests, but we also have a lot of different, you know. I can imagine how that would push and pull at things. Just a, I'm not going to say a one of a kind story, but a very unique story, because we didn't get into it, but Ben also has a brother in the band, so that's another element too.
Yeah, totally. The brother in the band. And just what I was thinking about was the fact that because it's so many different styles of music, it's like that whole, you know, ride to success, like indie band, small band, signed to a major, you know, it's really interesting to see them kind of climb the charts like that, because it's not, they're not really some one genre band that, like, yeah, has a natural progression to open for that same style. They're kind of like all over the map. So I guess that can maybe work in their benefit, but it's hard, I'm sure, for a label or any kind of promotion company to be like, we don't even know who to throw you with in terms of, like, billing or radio station or anything. So they're actually a perfect band for, like, today, where it's like self-release, like, we'll find our crowd.
You just took the words right out of my mouth. They would have been perfect today or on some of those festival type new metal-y show vibes in the late 90s, early 2000s. They just were at the wrong time, unfortunately. And he said it, and I think we said it back during our episode talking about them a couple weeks back. So it was an interesting story. It was really cool to hear that some of those movie type things happen where you get flown out, you play the Viper Room for Jimmy Iovine, he listens to a song and a half, and then he signs you. Like, that isn't just made up. It's actually stuff that happened. It's crazy.
No, it is wild, because I was, while you guys are talking, I was trying to think of a band that straddles that line between, you know, that could open for the bands they did open for, you know, like Papa Roach, and he mentioned Snot, but also not be out of place with Warped Tour. Like, I can't think of a single band that could have opened for Saves the Day and Papa Roach. There's no other band. Maybe Zebrahead? I don't know.
Not many, right?
Not many. And it's just a cool story for those guys. And I didn't expect for the Funk Junkies to come up in this episode tonight. I had no idea they were from, you know, that Phoenix area. But that's a band I got into in the late 90s. And kind of that 311 sound. So I can see that. When he said that, I was like, yep, I could see, especially in the Four Elements album, has that kind of 311 Funk Junkies type of sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And you know, if you haven't checked out Chronic Future in the past, go listen to Lines in My Face. There isn't a miss on that record. Go listen to Four Elements. That's a pretty cool record, too. They're different, but they're similar. You can see the progression a little bit. It was fun to hear him talk about that, too. But yeah, go check them out. They're a cool band, and they were a band that definitely should have been bigger than they were. I think timing was tough for them, but really cool story, and thanks to Ben for coming on with us tonight. That being said, check the socials, at PodioSlave on Twitter and Instagram, and then check or email us at PodioSlavePodcast@gmail.com. We're very active in those places. Hit us up.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you all, and thank you for checking us out. If it's your first time, we got a lot of great interviews, you know, some of the bands that would have fit right in with Chronic Future, Unwritten Law, Zebrahead, you know, bands of that ilk. So check those out, and thanks for listening.
Peace, Podheads.
Awesome. Thanks, Ben, and thanks, listeners. Cheers.